Welcome to On the Shelf, and welcome back to those joining me again. For today's theme, I'm riding on the back of another famous writer's words. This time it's Robert Burns and the well-known line from his poem, To a Louse. Burns, the only poet, I suspect, to have been inspired to write a poem on seeing one. Not the most beautiful of creatures, I can attest, having done the appropriate research before writing this episode. In church, when inspiration struck, it's possible rampant Rabbi's thoughts were on higher things than ladies' bonnets, but I reckon his lecherous gaze was drawn by the sight of the pretty neck beneath the bonnet, the wisps of soft hair escaping from it, the philandering poet wondering if heaven might be within his grasp here on earth. Well practised in the art of seduction, I imagine the first flirtatious line was already on his lips. Lips that might soon be kissing the beautiful Jenny. Then he sees it. Sees not some inferior form of masculinity, not some lousy rival for the lady's affections, but a wee insect, one he could squash between finger and thumb. And reconsidering his options, eyes cast down to his prayer book, he decides, rather than make love to the lady on whose head the wingless parasite has taken up residence, this time, his time might be better spent going home to write the poem already forming in his head, now that the censored words of seduction had left space for them. Since my Scottish brogue is nae good, I've used an anglicised form of the line, O would some power the gift give us, to see ourselves as others see us. Some people may look upon writing itself as a gift, some as a kind of therapy. I now see it as an essential part of my life, without which I feel incomplete. This making me sound a rather artsy-fartsy sort, which I don't like to think of myself as. But then, who am I to say? Others, seeing me from afar, or close enough to see a louse on my head, might view me quite differently. Even so, I've come to look upon writing as a way of rationalising my thoughts, of knowing what I think, to paraphrase another famous quote, that of the philosopher René Descartes, I write, therefore I think. The process of typing, bringing thoughts, as well as characters I know little or nothing about, to life. The flat, black and white typescript, building a colourful, three-dimensional picture of them, and the lives they are living. Often these imaginary new friends eat into my time to the extent that my real friends are neglected in favour of my latest companion, this fascinating character I've chosen to spend time with. Today I'd like to introduce you to a couple of old friends, to Lauren and to Aidan. Not themselves a couple, I hasten to add. I don't think they'd get on. First you'll meet Lauren. I've not seen her for a while. The last time we were together, she was at her hairdresser's. Like me, Lauren has had the same hairdresser for decades. You'll find her in a sombre, reflective frame of mind. She's seated in a chair at Marco's, waiting for him to attend to her. She notices it more and more now, sees the stark reality of her aging face staring back at her in that defiant, worn-down way. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who is the least fair of them all? She particularly notices it now that Marco has moved to this bigger, brighter salon. 3 years ago, when he was tucked away in the mews, she could still look upon her 55-year-old self with a degree of admiration, could note the prominence of her cheekbones, if not her chin, the relative smoothness of the skin beneath her eyes. Of course, the lighting there had helped. Although the room itself was rather gloomy, the mews salon was long and skinny, with barely any frontage on the mews itself. Each individual mirror had been lit from behind. Four etched squares on either side of the glass, through which eight small bulbs flatteringly glowed. So that within 2 months, between her last trim at the Mews and her first in the square, Lauren saw herself age by several years. "Why didn't you bring your lovely mirrors with you?" she'd asked Marco. "Their squareness, the etched squares running down, would have looked just right here." Marco's was now markers on the square, indicating the floor-to-ceiling glass frontage onto the pavement, the abundant natural light. Marco had mentioned the need for energy efficiency, while Lauren, eyeing Marco's colourist, perched on a stool by the gleaming counter, swinging her summer bare, freshly coloured legs, had wondered if sacking jewels might be a better place to start. Several small shops had once flourished in the square. In her teens before leaving home, and in her 20s on her infrequent visits back there, Lauren recalls a guitar maker's, a Cram to the Gunnels art shop, a picture framer's convenient next door, and a dusty hardware store which, had you the time to wait as they searched amongst the chaos, most likely had whatever it was you wanted. There had been a second-hand bookshop too, opposite the Fox and Grapes, a pub since 1789, until 2 years ago. All flourished while the twice-weekly market was held in the square, many still doing well when, under some health and safety edict, the number of stalls was reduced and Lauren, with two small children, married to David, returned to live in a nearby village. Although within months of her return, the market was restricted to Thursdays only. The final nail in the coffin, the killer stroke for the old square, was the decision to move what was left of the market to a small car park, no longer needed by the large supermarket close by, in whose name a swathe of wild, buddleia-strewn wasteland, inhabited, it was said, by feral children with Asperger's, had recently been tarmacked. The same feral children with Asperger's, Lauren supposed, who now used the empty moonlit space to play dodgems with whatever beat-up cars they could lay their hands on, or the not-so-beat-up ones they could beat up. Soon the few remaining shops were reclaimed as homes, but not by those who worked in the town. Until property prices on the rise again, the square was designated for a facelift. The crumbling north face and Georgian terrace gutted, and the North Gate, an elegant 5-star hotel, open its doors to those discerning, well-heeled types who believed they alone had discovered this stylish weekend getaway. While opposite the North Gate, Morton's Art Gallery soon replaced the guitar maker, the art shop and the picture framers. Lauren had met its owners, Richard and Zelda Morton, at its glitzy grand opening. Lauren was still married to David then, as, surprisingly, was Zelda to Richard, and even more surprisingly was still, since, according to Marco, Richard had jumped ship years ago, or rather, had jumped Alessandro, a Michelin-starred chef at La Peche d'Or, 10 miles up the coast. Zelda, Marco alleged, had spent so much money rolling back the years, she would have been better off buying a Pegaso rather than starting to look like one. Lauren, 53 at the time, taking in Zelda's 40-something face, 60-something neck, 70-something hands, vowed never to reclaim her own youth in such a way. "Ugh," she'd shivered as they drove home that evening. "Those oriental eyes, that tight mouth." "Whose?" David had innocently questioned. And when Lauren told him, "Ah, can't say I noticed. She looked pretty good to me. anyway. You'll not be needing any nips and tucks and bull semen, or whatever it is some women have syringed into them, will you? Lauren squirmed at the very idea. You've a naturally youthful face. He had taken his hand off the steering wheel to squeeze her thigh. You, my dear, he'd said, will grow old gracefully. She had been wearing a new pair of tights, opaque but shiny, black. He must find them sexy, she thought. Though afterwards, looking back, she realised it had already begun and felt a fool. Why had she not noticed the change in him? Those little things, the "my dear" said like that, like she was his mother-in-law, or even his mother, instead of his usual darling. The fact that had she cared to, had she dared to note it, his usual darling had become quite unusual of late. Noted that his squeeze had been more playful than sexy, more calculating. The index finger and opposing thumb clasp about her leg like calipers checking for cellulite. His palm not firm against her sometimes bare thigh, sometimes pushing up under her skirt. Though come to think of it, he'd not done that for some time either. So that, on reflection, the squeeze she had mistakenly interpreted as the beginning of something had, in fact, signalled the end of something. Marco runs a strand of Lauren's lacklustre locks through his fingers, lets out a despairing sigh, shakes his head. Too busy to condition, or just too lazy? Disgraced, Lauren lowers her eyes and confesses to being neither, which may, of course, be part of the problem. Actually, she confesses to Marco, as she might to a doctor hoping for a cure, I have been feeling rather lethargic lately. Wants to say, I felt a bit out on a limb, a little lost. You see, Marco, my mind's not my own these days. At least it's not the mind I wish to own. And what's more, my body's becoming someone else's. Marco rubs her hair between his fingers and thumb. She feels it pull at her scalp. Hears the sound of its brittle dryness rustling in her ear, like straw. Turning from her, Marco lets it fall. Bits of straw stick out above her left ear. She smooths them back with her palm. Her hair does not feel smooth. Okay, Jules, I'll finish your fleur. Janet is still waiting for her roots to be done. Then looking at her reflection in the mirror, lifting Lauren's shoulder-length hair from her neck, Marco's hands clamp onto her scalp, his blade fingers combing back through it, finding hair out on either side of her head. I look as if I've had a shock, she thinks. Lifeless, Marco pronounces. That's me, Lauren thinks. Want a coffee while I finish your fleur? Lauren shakes her lifeless head as Marco sidesteps over to Fleur, who, in Lauren's eyes, looks quite finished off as she is. Reflected in the large mirror they both share, Fleur is a picture, a rose stripped of all briars. A Fleur stripped of almost all her clothes, since, in the if-you've-got-it-flaunt-it way of the young these days, much of Fleur's smooth golden flesh is on view. Looking askance, Lauren watches Marco, hair dry in one hand, fingers of the other running through Fleur's long, lustrous mop, which, as if by magic, triples in volume. Watches the care he takes in grooming this unabashed beauty, who would look beautiful if she doused her head in a bucket of muddy water and let it dry in the sunshine. Watches and thinks, why can't you do that for me, Marco? I need it much more than Fleur does. Lauren can barely bear to look, and yet finds her eyes drawn back to the image of slutty perfection she sees beside her in the mirror. It has returned. It bubbles up inside, a head of steam slowly building. Lauren keeps having to switch it off before it boils over, before she explodes. She should be saving energy, conserving the little she has. Lauren's lifelessness, her depletion of energy, is related to her ex-husband David's new life and to her children's easy acceptance of it, particularly her daughter's. After 37 years in London, 20 of them going to the same hairdresser, I was living on the Suffolk coast when I wrote Reflections. I made two attempts at finding a hairdresser closer to home, taking the bus to the nearby town of Woodbridge, which, like Norwich, has quite a selection of hairdressers. But from neither of them did I leave with the confident spring in my step that Lauren feels leaving Marco's. And so I returned to what I knew and trusted, and continued to do so, still travelling to London, to my very own Marco. Preferring not to set stories in named known places, I became aware during the course of writing the story that elements of Woodbridge had been lurking at the back of my mind. But before you rush to book, there was no Northgate Hotel to get away to, and no Marco's on the square. Otherwise, who knows, I might still be going there. Although, as intuitive hairdressers sometimes do, it turned out Marco had a greater knowledge of me than I was aware of. Only when I had finished the final draft of Reflections did I come to reflect on the fact that the story the duplicitous Marco divulges to Lauren, and Lauren passed on to me, was one I had heard in the 1980s. It was, in fact, my own hairdresser's story, one I'd forgotten until Marco brought it to light. My second old friend is the antithesis of Rampant Rabbi. Aidan is a strictly one-woman man, one who has never forgiven himself for a drunken moment of madness at a Christmas party. This memory still haunting him, as well as memories of his instructive father, the father-in-law his beloved Flora never met. I'll read a middle section from A Blonde Woman. My wife, over the worst of the chemo, I returned to my daily commute. Took to wandering around the National Gallery at lunchtime, finding a worshipful solace there. I would drift aimlessly from room to room, sometimes looking at the paintings, sometimes not, sometimes gazing blankly at whatever hung before me, thinking of Flora, sometimes looking with great intensity at a single painting and thinking what my father might have said about it, while doing my best not to think of Flora, though she was never far away. And soon I found her, hiding around a corner. Except she had hair again, long strawberry blonde hair, trailing over shoulders far meatier than those my wife now possessed. And she had eyebrows and eyelashes and breasts. Much of her right breast exposed, the left partially covered by the material of her untied blouse, artfully slipped down over her meaty shoulders. Or maybe aggressively pulled down by the painter himself. Artistic license, Palma Vecchio might have said, or the Italian equivalent, his hands smelling of turpentine, green and yellow pigment collected under his fingernails, the pad of an oily thumb circling the model's nipple before, loosening the tie some more, he traced the curve of her breast beneath the thin white muslin, leaving the blue ribbon to echo it. All for the sake of art, you understand. He might have lied. Was she paid to be his sitter, or was she his payment? Her subdued expression suggests this might have been the case. The goddess not worshipped but tamed. This Flora, no white-winged angel, but a courtesan. But Aidan, Flora's fingers on the button of her hospital white nightgown. It won't seem quite so bad if you face it.
Not yet, I said. Not quite yet.
Though my younger son, our baby boy, he who 18 years before had suckled at that breast, had grown strong on its milk, could bear to face it. Could bear to ask his mother if she would allow him to see the place where his small, unthinking head once rested. The soft, maternal breast that had cushioned it, now gone. Gazing at a blonde woman, those other breasts, enhanced, grotesque, obscene, reared up in my memory. The scarlet taloned fingers shimmering down the sparkling, barely there dress to reveal her treasure trove, her prized possessions, pushed together into a deep valley in which I might bury myself. Getting off on her own hideous beauty, her terrible tackiness, those talons tugging at my belt, fumbling with my fly. No! I screamed through the red wine haze, stumbling out into the cold car park. Well, thanks very much, she spat as I pulled up my zip. Go fuck yourself. Searching for the exit, I turned to see her spilling out of the rear car door, one stiletto-heeled shoe on her foot, the other in her hand. Her hooker's dress barely more than a scrumpled belt of sequins around her bum and thighs. And shivering, tried to remember where I was in relation to my hotel. Back in the hotel room, I found several blonde hairs on my lounge suit, more on the trousers than on the jacket, and felt sick. What happened to that lion? Flora said when I wandered in at 9:30 that morning. That cooked breakfast. You're way too early. Too much wine, I groaned, holding my forehead. Not quite up to baby minding while I do the supermarket run, then?
I'd like nothing better, I said, going to wash my hands at the sink.
My parents had a painter in the house, one who had revamped the guest room, transformed the hall from gloomy grey to apple green, and was, I was told, putting a fresh lick over the kitchen. This man, the reason I, and not my mother, was sitting in the passenger seat beside my father as I returned home for the Easter holiday. He's overrun, of course, my father said. Should have finished the day before yesterday, but a nice chap all the same. A lot going on up top. He tapped his own receding temple to knowledge. Could have done better for himself, I'd say, had he tried.
Did you?
I asked. Did I what? Say, did you say that to him? I somehow knew my father's response.
I most certainly did.
It's never too late, I told him. There are evening classes in a myriad of subjects. There are open university degrees on anything you like. There's a world of opportunity awaiting minds up to the job. And I began to wonder if my mother had stayed at home in order to ensure this nice chap did not, as a parting shot, give the kitchen the Pollock treatment. But when we walked through the apple-bright hall to the half-lit kitchen, there he was, sitting at the table, a mug of tea in his hand, his newspaper propped against the teapot. Your wife will be back in 2 ticks, he told my father. Run out of milk. Thanks to yours truly, no doubt. Hello there, son. Good to be home, I bet. My gaze magnetically drawn to the newspaper, I assured him it most certainly was, both wanting to look, to take a closer look, and not knowing where to look. feeling an uncomfortable boy man, my body tingling, my face hot. Acutely aware that this was an important part of my education, but also aware that the subject was one my father considered unworthy of study. Fascinated, yet tainted by that fascination. While knowing other boys of the same age found this a far easier subject to absorb than did I. Observing my flushed cheeks, the direction of my gaze, my father shook his head and without a word whipped the tabloid from before the startled decorator's eyes.
"I'm sorry, Tom. You may sit at my table, you may drink my tea, you may use up my milk. I will not complain, but I cannot. I will not allow you to profane this kitchen with that pornographic rag masquerading as a newspaper."
And scrunching it into a crumpled ball, my father took it outside and threw it into the dustbin. "Here," he said, returning to pull the Times from his briefcase, plonking it before the bemused, stuttering Tom.
I mean, your good wife, you see, she never..."
"Well, anyways..." Poor befuddled Tom, taking a final swig of tea, said as he stood up. "I better be getting on, or I'll never be done."
"Take it home with you,"
my father instructed, folding the newspaper into a neat, portable size and holding it out to him like some mind-improving baton. "You might get a taste for it." Nodding, Tom slipped the newspaper into the capacious back pocket of his overalls, my father giving him a crusading smile of approval. Although Tom and I both knew that my father's favourite broadsheet would be in Tom's dustbin before sunset, or, if not, unread cat litter by dawn. Well, that's it for now. So until next time, thanks for listening.